Geekscape.com.
National Socialism, A Philosophical Appraisal by Colin Jordan. 21 years after the physical defeat of National Socialist Germany, in the outcome of her heroic struggle against the overwhelming array of men and materials marshalled against her by the Bolshevik Democratic Alliance, the appearance of this journal in 1966 reflects the revival of National Socialism, which is the feature of the day. That the creed should live on and manifest itself as it does now, after being subjected to two decades of the greatest campaign of vilification which the world has ever known, is a proof of its continuing validity and appeal and its worthiness for the future. It has survived the flames of war and the tempest of vilification because, when war has done its worst and vilification has run its entire gamut, National Socialism remains, in the final analysis, synonymous with higher man's will to survive, his instinct for health and strength, and his desire for beauty in life. And as long as that will, that instinct, and that desire remain upon this earth, National Socialism will remain indestructible. Beyond and behind all the minutiae of political implementation and the particularities of time and place, National Socialism, properly understood, is nothing less than an orientation of the mind, the dominant impulse of which is to live life to the full through the development of one's potentialities and the satisfaction of one's needs under conditions of natural competition and selection reconciled to cooperation within the organized community of the folk. In this, its roots go back to Plato's Greece and his conception of a natural life consisting in the full realization of man's true nature through the conducive power of government within his native community. It echoes the Roman notion of dutiful citizenship, the notion that the good and noble life consists in stoic service to the state. It revives the blood feelings and sense of community of the Nordic tribes of early Europe, the feeling that man is essentially a member of the folk, and that all members of the folk are bound together closely with reciprocal duties and obligations. National Socialism, in this way, reaches back to the old, healthy, organic values of life in revolt against the whole structure of thought, of liberalism and democracy, with its cash nexus, its excessive individualism, its view of man as a folkless, interchangeable unit of world population, its spiritual justification in a debased Christianity, embracing a sickly humanitarianism which will always tolerate a greater harm for the sake of avoiding a lesser one, and its fraudulent contention that the artificially induced and numerically determined wishes of the masses are all-important criteria. History is a saga of social decay and renewal. National Socialism is the 20th century's remedy of renewal for the great degeneration of modern times under the disintegrating, debasing and emasculating thought and practice which emerged with the disruption of the old medieval order of stability by the developing forces of capitalism and the Industrial Revolution, flourished under the laissez-faire liberalism of the 18th and 19th centuries, came to a climax under the democracy of the 19th and 20th centuries, and will result in the world triumph of communism by the end of this 20th century, unless National Socialism comes to power in time and over a sufficient area of the globe. National Socialism is, therefore, immensely more than a transitory political scheme. It is a historic tendency of rebirth, our age's movement of renaissance, a movement revolutionary in scope and spirit, seeking no compromise with the present order, its pernicious practices and its false values, but their complete replacement. As such, it is worldwide, and it is life-wide. It is worldwide in that, in its essentials, it is valid and vital universally, qualified only by the fact that it is Aryan in its emanation and tradition, and upholds and depends on the qualities that are to be found par excellence in the Aryan people. It is life-wide in that it is not an aspect of life, but the whole of life seen from one aspect. It is an attitude of mind expressible in respect of virtually anything and everything. National Socialism stands relentlessly opposed to every manifestation of ill health, ugliness, and degeneracy in the cultural and spiritual, no less than in the economic and political spheres. In fact, it constitutes a way of life. A man does not call himself a National Socialist as a mere label of intellectual endorsement. He is born with a propensity to National Socialism, his mind aesthetically craving the discernment and the fulfilment of a healthy pattern of life, and he not only thinks and feels, but acts as a National Socialist if he is really and entirely one. Total, in its scope and thought, National Socialism amounts to a philosophy and a faith. It evaluates good and bad, right and wrong, as that which benefits or harms the folk. And in place of the sentimental debility of the democratic mind, accepts that the end justifies the means, providing the means do not contradict the end. It sets a meaning and purpose of cosmic dimension to life as a personal fulfilment within the continuity and development of the folk between germination in the womb out of the bloodline of the folk and the metamorphosis of the grave with its physical redistribution to the universe. The basic criterion and primary value of National Socialism, from which all else springs, is, as Adolf Hitler makes clear in Mein Kampf, its concept of the folk, seen as man's essential environment, and indeed his extension of personality. The significance of the folk is, primarily, that of a racial community. It is the ethnical enlargement of the family. Man is not a self-contained unit and an end in himself, as the sages of liberalism and democracy assert. He belongs to his folk. His life, as a part, is interwoven with the life of the whole, not only present, but past and future. For while men come and go, the folk lives on. Continuous, eternal, providing its members perform their duties to it. Thus, in identifying himself with his folk, man prolongs himself through the multiplicity of his ancestors and his descendants, and thereby attains immortality. The folk exists in smaller and larger forms, ranging from the family to the clan, to the tribe or regional community, thence to the nation and beyond to the race. In modern times, the conception of the folk has been too largely identified with the nations of the contemporary states. The feeling of kinship and community, which rightly expanded from the tribe and petty kingdom to the modern nation-state, has, however, become far too concentrated at this level. The lower and smaller, But equally important, communities within the nation-state have been disrupted and deprived of vitality, while the expansion of folk consciousness from the level of the nation-state to that of the entire race has been checked. Yet folk feeling, to be wholesomely potent, must flow from its roots through the local and provincial communities to the limits of the race, because the full security and prosperity of the parts can only be found in that of the whole. Today, and in the future, National Socialism must embody this essential extension of the feeling of kinship and community beyond the bounds of the contemporary nation-state and conventional nationalism, so that the nation-state becomes an intermediate unit in the structure of the folk, and its nationalism and racialism become integrally subordinate to a nationalism of the whole race. At the same time, the local communities require to be revived, the provincial sub-nations recognized and respected, and peoples subject to an undesired alien rule given their ethnic freedom by separation. National Socialism's belief in the folk as a basic value and its totality of outlook result, figuratively speaking, in thinking with the blood on all questions. This immediately and inevitably gives rise to the definition of citizenship as a matter of race. Only those who are members of the folk are members of the nation, and only those who are members of the nation can be citizens of the state. To paraphrase the fourth of the 25 points of Adolf Hitler's NSDAP. It also generates the belief that it is necessary not merely to preserve the racial character of the folk, but also, by eugenic measures, to improve the quality of the folk. It is National Socialism's revolutionary contention that the way of real progress lies in the breeding of better human beings. Since all the citizens are of the same race, they have a transcendent bond of kinship, uniting them as blood brothers above all sectional and class differences and personal distinctions. National unity, cohesion and corporate life in the place of class warfare of left and right is one of the great secondary principles of National Socialism. All occupations and pursuits, all manner of persons and all fields of activity must be integrated into the corporate life of the community. The social feeling of oneness must find practical expression in, and in turn be stimulated by, a sincere and profound concern for social and economic justice. Consciousness of kinship and care for the collective good of the folk demand that every citizen must have an equal opportunity to develop and exercise his talents and rise according to his merits, and that every citizen must receive a fair return for his services to the community, and even the simplest worker, an assurance of the necessities of life. Thus, we arrive at the socialist element in National Socialism. This is not the Marxist socialism of state ownership of the means of production and distribution, which is the economic over-government of the ant heap, and as objectionable as the predatory individualism of the capitalist system, which is the economic under-government or anarchy of the jungle. Instead, it is folk socialism, or the regulation of private enterprise for the equitable division of its fruits under equitable conditions. The economic injustices and social evils of capitalism have fostered Marxism with its pernicious form of public control of the economy, and the alternative to both lies in National Socialism. The folk ideal, which entails the defence of the race, the unity of the nation, and the welfare of the people engenders National Socialism's principle of leadership and an elite in the service of these objectives. Its conception of a natural order is one which not only ordains that men are born into the folk for a life within the folk, but also that they possess hereditary differences of capacity to serve the community. Accordingly, for the maximum good of all, the superior must lead the inferior. The natural leaders must be selected, established as a hierarchic elite under a supreme leader, and empowered to fulfill their function. Unlike liberalism, National Socialism does not regard the directive power of the state as something essentially regressive, but instead as a great beneficial power of guidance and arbitration, encouragement and protection. It upholds the dictum, all for the folk and the folk for all. It sanctions whatever means are necessary in whatever fields to ensure that everyone and everything in the community is in harmony with this. It sees the duty of the National Socialist government as the representation of the will of the folk, conceived not as the transitory whim of some democratic mob, but as the higher interest of the community, viewed in historical perspective, as a continuity of purpose, embracing not only the general good of the present, but the heritage of the past and the needs of the future as well.
You're tuned in to Radio Aryan.
Building the Vanguard by Colin Jordan. The first requirement of the true elitist is the willpower to turn his back on the tempting but futile distractions of ordinary politics, and the second is to purge his mind of all attachment to the existing state and system and society, abstracting himself to the uttermost from the grip of this alien world, so as to be in total rebellion against its decadence, becoming a fragment of the future. The latter demands devotion to an advanced degree of self-education in at least all of the basic knowledge of a mentally equipped elitist, including an insight into the historical context of our struggle, an appreciation of all the major facets of the correlated and universally prevalent degeneration, the cultural and social and biological and spiritual, no less than the plainly political, necessary for that wholeness of view, essential for the fullness of combat of the complete belligerent, and an adequate knowledge of relevant law, police procedure, methods of hostile infiltration and provocation and corruption and intimidation and security precautions against this. After, and only after, this comes that specialization in any of the great variety of skills legitimately useful to the true elitist in building the elite now, or acting now against the system to hasten its breakdown, or preparing for action in that eventual situation. In all of this, not only has the elitist the task of training to become as far as possible a self-contained unit of the revolution, but as one becomes joined to others in a gradually evolving corporate structure, that structure has to become more and more the state of the future, developing in advance within the declining body politic of the present. Here, we are essentially concerned with the study and application of positive arts and sciences, not in the desultory dabblings of dilettantes, and this involves work galore for those concerned.
Training thus professionally for the struggle, the political soldier of the vanguard needs to articulate a credo whereby each day becomes dedicated to life on a higher plane. In this struggle is to be accepted as the assertion of self in the purpose of life, loyalty and courage and strength in struggle as the supreme virtues. The folk, the community of the race, as greater than self, and the highest end, good and evil, as precisely what benefits or harms the folk, and nothing else, and race and our beliefs in support of our race, seen in its entirety, as transcending the geography of countries and the structures of states, there lying our highest allegiance, and with, in consequence, every fighter for our race and our beliefs anywhere in the world being our comrade. In the beginning, you may be alone in all this, an isolated revolutionary agent in enemy-occupied territory. If so, understand at once that this is no cause for lament and despondency, and no excuse for inhibition and inaction, but the very test of initiation as to your suitability, because the true elitist is precisely the one capable of operating on his own, if needs be, not the dependent weakling who needs some pre-existing organization to take him by the hand and arrange things for him. Thus, the initial isolation of a person, or couple of persons, is highly salutary, and those who, because of this, lapse back into the life of the ordinary political herd are exactly those who are incapable and unsuitable for the exacting role of the elite. Therefore, cast out any feelings of helplessness by uncovering the power which lies within you, the power to make yourself a most effective weapon. Be confident in the superiority of quality against quantity, whereby the trained and experienced elitist can have an effect far beyond that of the little people on which conventional politics rely. Be assured that numbers are more than anything else an illusion, whenever regardless of quality, being weakness masquerading as strength. Realize that the greatest force in the world is the power of the will residing in the excellence of the few. Believe this, a tiny minority, which is good enough, dedicated enough, knowledgeable enough, trained enough, organized enough, can move mountains and can topple the vulnerable edifice of the complicated modern state. But of course, having said that, it has also to be stressed that we need as many as there are of the right people, and so the task of each and every elitist, along with self-development, is to contact and recruit and coordinate our kind. This is essentially a matter of the most careful personal approach, only seeking out those who have already proven themselves suitable, recruiting by invitation, and never in the indiscriminate manner of mass organizations by advertising or canvassing at large. Thus, never seek to bring in somebody who is truly a stranger, recommending himself only by his claims of inclination. It is here, paradoxically, that existing organizations will be useful to us by bringing people together and exhibiting their worth so that we can conveniently watch and select. In doing so, however, constant vigilance is necessary to avoid, for the sake of this access to recruits, becoming involved in conventional activities at the cost of our proper pursuits. In recruitment and operation, there can be no room for illogical and wasteful divisions detrimental to an endeavour seeking to draw massive additional strength from that intensity or unity which results from a profound harmony of minds. Just as there is no place for the barriers of nationality, so too is there no room for any exclusion or relegation of women as inferior. This, contrary to a recognition of the equal, joint, and complementary worth of both sexes, despite
some differing capabilities. Similarly, there is no room for friction between the generations when you are best to be judged as old as you are young in heart and young as you are useful, and no place for class cleavage where the only demarcation which really matters is between us and the rest. In organization, it is imperative to proceed on the basis of small local cells of six or so, this dispersal offering the highest prospect of security, while providing a suitable size of operational unit, and with a maximum autonomy, consistent with unified purpose and concerted action.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
A letter from Colin Jordan to Gerald Kaufman, MP. Sir, I have been informed by Detective Inspector T.W. Story of the Harrogate Police that you have laid a complaint against me, alleging that I have sent you a label bearing a cartoon depicting Uncle Sam exhorting people to fight for Israel in the recent Middle East War. This allegation, as I have informed the Harrogate Police, is an untrue, malicious, and mischievous one, and I have accordingly laid a complaint against you on this score. I am, of course, well aware of your devious purpose behind this stratagem of false complaint. You believe that, while lurking cosily in the background, you can, by means of your status as an MP, and by the alien and misbegotten provisions of Part 3 of the 1986 Public Order Act, so long and so feverishly agitated for by your kind, bring about a Soviet-style intrusion into my home, and thereby a search for and seizure of my property, out of which you hope that some case may be concocted against me, and some sort of punishment inflicted on me. Fearing the truth of what I say, you seek to silence me in this tyrannical fashion. Masquerading in the garments of freedom and democracy, you and your kind are in fact entirely averse to facing in open and fair controversy any case against the Jewish community in this country of which you are a prominent member. Instead, you have for years been conspiring to take away from Englishmen their ancient freedom of expression as far as it concerns the Jews, agitating for first one new law and then another to prohibit and penalize such expression in the pretense that it is racial hatred. Even with the repressive provisions of the current Public Order Act, you are still not satisfied and want more, from which it is perfectly apparent that you will never be content until any and all comment on the Jews which is unfavourable is rendered illegal. In all these endeavours detrimental to English freedom, you and your kind are in fact the most potent cause of the very anti-Semitism which you purport to combat, and of this I firmly accuse you here and now, since by those endeavours you will sooner or later, naturally and assuredly, create bitter resentment among more and more people who otherwise might well remain untouched by literature and speeches from my side. Hatred. Hatred against those like myself who dare to continue to criticize and condemn you and your kind is an emotion that you and your kind must be well acquainted with through your own plentiful manifestation of it in your campaigns for suppression.
You yourself will perhaps be best qualified to discern how far this emanates from the teachings of your Talmud, and how far the current and continuing distribution of this piece of literature, with its many and varied vicious references to Gentiles, can well be said to contravene Part 3 of the Public Order Act 1986. Although, of course, you will have no fear of any enforcement of that part of the Act against your community by authorities so subservient to your community. Conceivably, through the elaborate espionage apparatus of your community, you have already come to know that I have reached a draft stage with a book entitled Merry England 2000. Outlining the hideous shape of things to come in this country, given the ascendancy of such as you, and that, therefore, this is why this manuscript was with special seal removed by the police for your protection and comfort. Be certain, however, that it will be redrafted if necessary, even if it be ultimately honoured by being scheduled as one of the banned books of Britain. That, as pretext, you should have complained about the precise item of literature you have done, is revealing regarding the arrogant pretensions of you and your kind. The cartoon on it cites two foreign countries, one of them Israel, and in no way refers to the Jews in Britain in any derogatory manner, unless it is that you identify yourself with one of those foreign countries, Israel, you cannot claim to be involved. As far as my knowledge goes, you have been careful so far, not so to identify yourself, but if you do now come out in the open and so identify, I wish you good speed in implementing that identification by your permanent departure for Israel. Failing that, you might remember that the expulsion of the Jews by our good King Edward I, to the universal joy of the nation, in 1290, has never yet been formally revoked, and your presence in our land, let alone our Parliament, may therefore be deemed illicit. As one whose ancestors were tilling the soil of Yorkshire centuries before your most immediate ones came here from the ghettos of the East, your people, taking an advantage of ours to aspire to ascendancy over us and now to censor and silence us, conclude by informing you in relation to your efforts to make patriotism a crime and to incriminate me that by far the greatest criminals in this land today, and indeed the very greatest in our history, are those who have been responsible for allowing and encouraging the coloured invasion of our country and the forced integration of our people, and responsible for allowing and promoting Jewish ascendancy in it over our affairs. If you are one such accomplice in this great crime of betrayal of the British folk, then you are most certainly one of those arch criminals that I have in mind. Yours sincerely, Colin Jordan.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.